stories?
I did. And really bad poetry. I wrote a lot of really incredibly bad poetry, which was wisely rejected by some of the better journals in Canada.
Well, you were into Sylvia Plath and Anais Nin and all that kind of stuff,
of course,
right?
I was. Yeah, of course. You know.
Which is, so there's a great romance to writing, I guess there is. But you know what? I find it really hard. I find it, a struggle, toiling, and it's a different, like, I have to write, I'm doing journalism.
I was going to say, you're working in nonfiction, you're doing journalism.
Yeah.
You know, it is hard. I mean, I'm not one of those people who sort of sit down at the page and the angels descend and gently hover, you know, wavering their wings over me until the words come. That's not what it's like for me. It's work. It is work. But it's, you know, I always say that writing is like having a 600-pound St. Bernard in the house, you know, and the weather is much like it is today. You know, it's raining, and it's sleet, and it's, you know, windy, and it's dreadful, and all you really want to do is sit in front of the fire and read your book, but there's this 600-pound St. Bernard that's standing there with its leash in its mouth demanding that you walk it, and the more you ignore it, the more likely it is to pee in your carpet and eat your couch. So ultimately, it just becomes easier to walk the damn dog than it does to ignore it. And that, for me, oddly, is sort of the way writing is. It's a nagging. It's an urging that if I don't get to the page and get to work, I become increasingly neurotic until my husband looks at me and says, don't you think you'd like to go and write something today, dear? You know? And he's right. I'm always much better at when I've done my work.
But you can't be, it's hard because sometimes you feel like you're sort of like a machine at times, like, I know I have to do this.
Yeah.
I have to do it today. But because you work from home, and it's writing is all about discipline too.
It is.
You have to really discipline yourself.
Yes. At least I do. I mean, there are writers who say they only write when the muse rings the doorbell. I can't imagine, you know. I don't think anybody'd ever show up. So, you know, when I'm working on a novel, the novel has to go forward by 500 words a day. But I start every day by reading what I wrote yesterday, which means if I don't like what I wrote yesterday, now I've got to write 1,000 words today. You know, and some days, you know, that doesn't take too long. You know, it takes maybe 3 or 4 hours. Other days, 11 o'clock at night, I'm still in my jammies, haven't had a shower yet, and apparently not going to bed anytime soon. But, you know, that's the way it goes. If I don't do that, then I risk losing the book. I risk losing it.
Do you read out loud? Do you read about?
I read my own work out loud.
Yep, read it out loud so that you get the idea of all the voices. Wow. I want to talk about our daily bread.
Let's
picking up the pen and facing the page. Wow. What was the creative process? How did
this book show up?
Yeah. What's the creative arc behind it? The research arc behind it.
It's a very long arc, honestly. When I was 16, I lived in Nova Scotia. I was 16, 17. While I was there, I heard all of these rumors, at least I thought they were just rumors, about these people who lived in the mountain. Those people. Them.
Yeah, them.
And and all of these dreadful things about child prostitution and deformed babies and incest. And I mean, just every horrific rumor you could imagine. And I assumed it was all nonsense. I assumed it was all so much sort of rural legend. You know, I'm saying, what is this? The Ozarks, pardon me. But, I just didn't see it was possible.
Yeah.
And mostly I didn't think it was possible because I couldn't believe that if it were true, somebody wouldn't have gone in to stop it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, in the early 80s, Donna Goler, who was one of the little girls involved, she told her teacher what was happening to her. And the teacher she told didn't happen to be from that neighborhood. She wasn't even from Nova Scotia, as I recall. She was from Ontario. And she went, oh, my God, you know, this can't happen. And so she called somebody in the RCMP. And the person she called in the RCMP also did not happen to be from the area. And then the entire story broke. But it haunted me. It really haunted me because I thought I had become one of those people who hadn't done anything.
Right.
And how could that be? How could we just let these horrible things happen to children? Then I found out, of course, that it hadn't just been happening to these children. That this had been going on for generation after generation after generation.
Yeah, and
the reason, I came across this book called On South Mountain.
Right.
Which is a phenomenal nonfiction journalistic account of these incidents. And what I learned from that book was that, in fact, this whole community had been founded by a group of Puritans who had left New England because the kind of Puritanism they were practicing in New England wasn't quite puritanical enough.
Yeah.
Hard to imagine, I know. And so when they arrived in this neck of the woods, anyone who did not conform to a very strict set of rules was cast out. They were shunned. They weren't allowed to go to school. They couldn't come to the churches. They weren't allowed to marry. You know, they weren't given any jobs. And so they became this very isolated group of people, and they became demonized over time.
Yeah.
And so the assumption was, well, there's nothing you can do. What do you expect from them? And now, of course, we're living in a time when we are bombarded with this idea that we have to be, it's either us or them. And pick of them.
Gays
and heterosexuals, Muslims and Jews, Democrats and Republicans. I'm living in the States these days. I hear a lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's always somebody who has to be the other.
That's right.
Seem to be defining ourselves more and more. So this haunted thing in my head from this community seemed to me to be the way to investigate this sort of very dangerous, I consider very dangerous phenomenon. But it also gave me an opportunity to imagine or to give examples of how unlikely friendships can transform everything.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of people in this book. There's one, of course, the main character, Albert Erskine, the family name I've used is Erskine. He comes down off the mountain because he wants to get out, but he's torn because all the kids are left up there. You can't leave the children, right?
Yeah.
And then there's a woman in town who has been leaving things up in the compound where they live for many years anonymously, and she's not ready to give up on these people, and she won't attach herself to the group think that's going on down in the town.
Yeah, exactly.
Things began to shift there.
Yeah, and you kind of, the reader's probably left with the question, well, who's worse, the people on the mountain or the ones that are kind of just letting it go on, or thinking we're better than they are, right?
Well, that's exactly it, Coral, because I think part of the problem is that unless we are willing to look at the shadow in the mirror, unless we are willing to say that under the right set of circumstances, I too might be doing exactly these sorts of things. At the Stanford, I don't know whether you remember the Stanford experiment, the psychology experiment that was done in the late 60s, early 70s. I can't remember which university, Stanford University. But there was a university professor there who put together a group of students, some as prisoners and some as guards. And within 48 hours, the guards had become sadists. 48 hours. And he, in fact, became complicit. And they had to shut the experiment down a week and a half early because it was so obvious how quickly people
mindset.
Given ultimate power over other people can become the worst of humanity. And we see this in Abu Ghraib. We're perfectly good people under other circumstances.
But
the potential is in all of us.
Yes,
and if we don't recognize that in all of us, how do we stop ourselves from getting sucked into the mob mentality?
Yeah, exactly. And what was I going to say? I lost my train of thought there. Oh, well, to them, to the Erskines on the mountain, it's like, to them, it's normal.
It is normal.
That's their lifestyle. That's how they live. And to them, everything else is abnormal, which is kind of horrific. But, I mean, the kids, that's all they know.
Well, and that's true. I mean, if you've ever spoken to somebody who's been raised in an abusive family, it's the children don't really understand that this is abuse. They may know it's awful, but they don't know that there's an alternative.
Yeah, exactly. To them, it's just something that they do.
The world is the world. Yeah.
Yeah, and they don't find out about it until years later, until
that's
they get
right.
outside of a sort of like a bubble that they're in.
Absolutely.
So this is phenomenal. You also do there's a viewpoint not just from Albert but other characters in the book.
Correct.
And you kind of put, it's like, I guess, being an empath or putting your, how do you put yourself in that?
Well, I think that one of the great gifts of literature is empathy.
Yeah.
It's when we read a book, if it's well written, if we read a book about someone who is very different than us, what literature offers us is the ability to live in their skin. I mean, nothing else can do this. Film cannot do this.
No.
Theater can't do it. Music can't do it.
No.
All of it can do it to varying degrees.
Right.
But it's only with really well-written literature that we go inside the sensations of another person. We think what they think. We see through their eyes. We feel through their senses. Yeah, apparently it has something to do with the limbic system in the brain, the way we take information in, and it feeds through the limbic system, which is why in literature it's only the sense details. If you write in ideas, it doesn't have the same effect. But if you write in things that are tactile, things that are sensual, then you feel what the characters are feeling.
I get that. I also read an excerpt from Radiant City,
mm-hmm.
and it's like I'm thinking of Matthew, and I'm thinking,
yes.
And you hear, you see his thoughts the way you write them, and they're not like they're little phrases. They're like little inner thoughts coming out,
right?
And there's kind of like a little musicality to them. It's sort of
thank you, thank you.
I like that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I really like that style, but you're also highly descriptive too, which is really interesting as well. I don't know. I also read Rat Medicine. There's always something at the end of these, like the end of the excerpt. It's kind of like, what?
What? Wait a minute. I gotta go back and read that again.
Right, and it's read between the lines too. There's a lot of subtext, which I think is great.
Well, Rat Medicine's an interesting little collection of short stories. That was the first thing
I
ever published.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It was written in early sobriety. I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Yes.
I'm very open about this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think it was Isabel Huggin who said that alcohol flows like an unholy river through these stories. And it does, of course, because I think writers, you know, we tend to write about what's obsessing us. And when you're getting sober, what's obsessing you is getting sober.
Yeah.
So there was a lot in there about alcoholism and the way it had affected not only my life, but the lives of people around me.
Well, they say that you write best what you know about.
Coral, I have to say, I don't know whether I agree with you on that one.
Okay.
I think you can write very well on what you know. But I think it's more important for a writer to write about what they want to know about.
Yeah.
What they're curious about, what enthuses them, what, you know, Joan Didion said that she writes to find out what she thinks about things. And if she had any access to her own mind, she wouldn't write. And there's some of that, I think, in all writers. You know, this book, I mean, I didn't live like these people lived. You know, I'm certainly not any longer, you know, a 10-year-old little girl who's been bullied in her family. And yet, we're fascinated by the lives of others and what they can bring to us. In Radiant City, you know, it's about a war correspondent who suffered a mental breakdown. I did not go to Rwanda. I did not go to Sarajevo. I did not go to Hebron, these places I wrote about. But I did speak to a lot of journalists who had been there and who had seen these things and shared their experiences with me. I was fascinated by what calls a war correspondent to keep going into war zones.
I mean, I get it, but
you start shooting at me, I'm going home.
Yeah.
You know, but these people keep going
back
and over and over again, and I wanted to understand what that was about.
And that's fascinating. The human condition, the human spirit is fascinating, and you don't know what lengths people will go to.
Absolutely.
And they're driven, and sometimes you don't even know what it is you're driven by.
Yeah.
You're just heading towards something, and sometimes you're not. You think you're going in one direction, and you end up heading in an entirely different direction altogether. Which I also
find part of that,
fascinating.
Of course, is those subconscious forces. I mean, that shadow in the mirror I was talking about, that sort of Jungian theory that there is a shadow side of us that if we don't access, is always liable to jump up at inopportune moments and bite us in the butt.
Yeah.
And I think that happens far more than we recognize.
You also teach as well.
I do.
You have a class called Sharpening the Quill.
Sharpening the Quill,
which I really like.
And you also teach. You teach prisoners.
I teach. So I have a merry band of creative felons that I work with.
They probably are looking for writing for them would be the ultimate escape when you think about it. Creative writing, especially.
Sometimes. Sometimes, I mean, sometimes it is, you're right, pure escapism that they want to write about. You know, the prison that I taught in last year is a prison, it's a high security jail penitentiary, and it's peopled by almost entirely members of the Blood Gang. The Crips, for all those reasons, they put elsewhere.
Yeah.
They don't play well together.
No, that's true.
So I was sort of amazed at how many of these guys wanted to write these really sort of ultra-violent urban novels. You know, and you know, then you'd sort of talk to them about, well, why don't we start with something, you know, a little less graphic. I mean, it was quite extraordinary to me that there was, but of course, it's in the psyche. I mean, this is the violent sort of world that these guys were dealing with. But it was all tremendously stereotypical when we first started working. And then when you ask them to access some of their own stories and their own past, I mean, I had a couple of students, and the stuff they worked on, it just blew me away. I mean, natural writers, and you know, here they are doing 15 to 20.
It all comes from a place in the past, usually, or they're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, you know, I said to one of the more talented writers in my class, I said, you know, you have to explain to me how you've ended up here.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's a very smart young man, and he said, you know, Lauren, in the wealthy white neighborhoods, the kids, they hit 14, 15, and they want to do extreme sports, you know, helicopter skiing and, you know, swimming with sharks and all this stuff.
Yeah.
He said, we don't have a lot of access to this stuff, and the gangs are our extreme sports. And he talked about how if at that age something to belong to, something a little radical, something slightly dangerous had come along, it would have been that. And then by the time they realize they've been lied to by the gang leaders who really are just, you know, they're just profiteers. I mean, it's all about cash, baby. It's not about anything else.
Yeah.
By that time, they're covered in tattoos and they've got a criminal record and they can't get out. And it's heartbreaking. It really is heartbreaking.
I have to ask you this question. I know our Daily Bread is just out, but do you have another book sitting in the back of your head?
Well, I do. I mean, there's a couple of things. There's a book that I'm, you know, just about hoping will be ready, that's set in the 7th century. So, of which I knew nothing before I started writing. So there you are. I knew nothing about the 7th century. But I was fascinated by this moment in
English. Ron's laughing. What?
Sorry?
Ron's laughing.
Ron's laughing. Well, the reason Ron's laughing is because I decided I had to go over to England and do research.
And I dragged
my husband from the south of England to the north of Scotland on what he called the Anglo-Saxon forced march northwards. But we spent a lot of time talking to anthropologists and archaeologists and church historians. And I was fascinated by this moment in English history when suddenly the king shows up and the old religion is gone, the old gods are gone, and we're all Christian. And how do you survive this sort of tumult if you refuse to bow the knee to the new faith chosen for political reasons?
You're done.
What do you do then? And so I was, given all the religious tension in the world these days, I thought that was an interesting allegory for that. And then that one's just about done. And then unfortunately, you know, again, going back to personal history, both of my brothers, my half-brothers committed suicide.
Oh.
And I've been trying to figure out a way to talk about that. And I originally thought I might do something in nonfiction, and I found I really couldn't do that. I just couldn't get a handle on how to approach it. So I've started work. It's just in the very early stages, but it's almost a fairy tale take on a sister who goes into the underworld in search of her brother. And I think it's going to be a way for me. I don't know whether it'll ever get written, but I'm working on it now. And it's also about how narrative changes things. You know, when you have dramatic events like this in a family, the entire narrative of the family changes.
Oh, definitely.
And what do we do with the story? What do we do with that story? So that's what I'm trying to figure out right now.
That would be...
I expect it'll keep me busy for a few years.
Yeah, I'm guessing. But you had, like, I can tell, again, from reading Stubborn Season, that you had, your childhood was pretty wild.
Complicated,
complex, yeah. And we all, you know, you can, especially if you have similar sort of things happening, you read this and think, oh, you can relate to this right away. Mm-hmm. Maybe not mm-hmm. the same extreme, but... Yeah, I've been there. I know what you mean, and that's always great for readers as well. I think you're right. The reader can identify with characters, and they can identify with the author, and it's almost like a healing process sometimes. Like I read your piece that you wrote about forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That was extraordinary. I think you're right.
That's a psychology today piece. Yeah. That was it. Yeah.
I think you're right. You have to do that, because if you don't do that, if you don't try and figure out the other person or what made the other person do what they did, you're going to spend the rest of your life sort of angry, or it'll eat you up. You know,
it is. It's corrosive. It's very corrosive. And I think what was interesting for me with that book was the, you know, I do have a family member who suffers from mental illness, and the mother in The Stubborn Season. It's a story about a girl growing up in a family where there's mental illness, great depression in the house, great depression out of the house. And, you know, I had always sort of jokingly said the only thing worse than being around this mentally ill person I'm speaking of was being her.
Yeah.
And by the time I had finished writing that book, that wasn't a joke any longer, because I'd had to do so much research into the kind of mental illness that she had. And I had to, again, empathize. I had to imagine what it might be like to live inside this terrible torment. And there's a moment in the book where Margaret, who is the woman we're speaking of,
right,
she wants to say something nice to her daughter. She wants to say something nice. And out of her mouth comes this dreadful insult, this cruelty. And she presses her lips together, and her daughter sees that she doesn't want to say what she's saying, and she's fighting to say something else, but she's not capable of it. It's not that she's withholding love; it's that it's not there.
Yeah,
and that to me seemed to be just the most barren of emotional landscapes. So I did develop a tremendous amount of empathy for the person on whom that character is based.
I want to maybe I should ask Dave this. Can you tell me a little bit about the Wordsworth event tonight, how this is going to...
Yeah.
Sure thing, Coral. basically, Wordsworth has held spring and fall author events for 25 years.
As long I
as
know.
Been in existence.
Yeah.
Basically, tonight we thought we'd try something a wee bit different. Most authors, and I'm just going to go out on a limb, don't particularly care to read from their work, because most authors, like most musicians, go out on tour. And
right.
They tend to read the same piece night after night after night. And, well, we thought we would just simply do a Q&A, because most authors, I think, like to talk rather than be on. And there is a difference, and I think that comes across in performance.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, we're just hoping to draw a crowd, weather aside. Stubborn Season, Daily Bread, and Radiant City are all books that hit the sweet spot for a reader, I think.
Yes.
They move like a gazelle, and there's literary chops all the way through here. It's work that leaps off the page and stays with you afterward. And to pick up on Lauren's point around empathy, that is absolutely the get for reading and for writing fiction.
Yes.
There's nothing else that can do it. Nothing else has that interiority. Without the interiority, you can't get the empathy. Martha Nussbaum, the American philosopher, proved this years ago by taking a bunch of people and running a control group and basically feeding a portion of that control group fiction and then running Q&A after that. How do you actually get into someone else's head? How do you actually prevent an Abu Ghraib?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you do it by feeding them Marilyn Robinson, basically. you do it by not screwing around and feeding them real fiction. I don't mean fiction that can't be read. I don't mean Marcel Proust or something that's going to...
Something
that's going to overwhelm even a good reader. I mean something that hits the sweet spot in terms of universality.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not easily done. At any rate, we're going to riff on these very things tonight, and I hope do it with a little more fun than that. But it's going to be a fine evening.
Well, you know, I don't know whether you realize how lucky you are in this area to have this bookstore.
Oh, I do.
This is an extraordinary group of readers at this store. You know, you go into a Chapters and you ask somebody there to recommend a book. You know, this is the last book I liked that I loved, and what do you recommend? And they go, well, I don't know, Dan Brown's selling really well.
I mean,
it's just shocking. But, you know, you go into Wordsworth, they know you. They know what you've read. They know what, and they will challenge you a little bit on your reading. It's phenomenal.
Oh, I know.
Phenomenal.
I think Now, am I right here? I think CBC voted them one of the 10 best bookstores in Canada.
Yes, they did.
So we're very, I'm so, this is the first time I've been asking Mandy and Dave if I could do this for a while. So I'm so thrilled that you were able to come and
well,
do this.
I'm just delighted. And this is great. You know, I will say this is the only bookstore I'm coming to on this tour. It's the place I want it to be.
And you'll have a great crowd tonight as well, because you're right, everybody there loves to read. They are very passionate, and Dave and Mandy and the staff at Wordsworth have a way of making you very passionate about new authors.
Yes,
Canadian authors. Claudia Day is a favorite of mine as well, who I met recently.
Lovely!
And she's great, so I'm hoping to talk to her sometime.
Oh,
her
good!
She's a great writer. And it inspires me, talking to other authors, even though I'm writing journalism, I'm doing not that's what I'm not what I mean, but I do a lot of editorial as mm-hmm. well as editorial work these days, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's like, I have to find some passion in this piece I'm writing about lighting trends for Christmas, right? But you, gotcha. I mean, you have to do that kind of stuff. But
well, maybe you can ask David and Mandy to start feeding you quotes on various subjects. You know, Christmas tree lighting. You'll find a quote for that in some great book. And open your piece with that.
This is going to get way too Dickensian in a hell of a hurry here.
No kidding.
We are starting out this evening, by the way, I didn't mention before. That's at 7 o'clock tonight.
Yes.
We'll wrap